Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, how many times has somebody turned around to you and shrugged their shoulders and said, whatever? How many times have Eric's doing it right now? How many times have you said that to somebody else? Well, my first guest says, you know what? Whatever doesn't work here anymore. Today's show is all about being fabulous and finding true belonging. Coming later in the show, we'll talk with Dr. Brantley. He says that despite being connected 24/7, many people are lonelier than ever and don't know where or how to begin connecting with others. Not surprising, really. But I Googled Lonely People 2011 and I got over 37 million results. I then Googled songs about being lonely and got over 58 million results. Dr. Brantley has some practices for overcoming loneliness and connecting with others. And we'll talk with him in the second half of today's show. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Ellen Lubin Sherman to discuss the essentials of being fabulous. If we step into our fabulous selves, I suspect loneliness will be a thing of the past. And so this is a good pairing with today's program, I think. Ellen Lubin Sherman began her business career feeding gossip to New York gossip columnist, or I should say the New York gossip columnist, Liz Smith. She then went on to work for some of America's top communications firms, advising brands such as The Gap, Perrier Water, and Martha Stewart. And in 2003, she founded Launch, an executive coaching and branding firm for business leaders who want to break away from the pack and lead with charisma. Ellen speaks on society, culture, manners, and style, and has just released a fabulous new book, as we would expect, called The Essentials of Fabulous, because whatever doesn't work here anymore. Ellen Lubin Sherman, welcome to the show.
So much, and thank you for the wonderful intro.
What a lovely book. Of course, it's visual, and I'm very visual, so I love books that are not just all writing.
Well, we had a lot of talent on my team, and everybody put their heart and soul into the project, and it really did come out quite beautifully. So it's nice to look at, but there's a lot of material in there.
Yeah, some very good content in there. And before we get to that, I want to just step back to the beginning of your career. I said that you started feeding your career feeding gossip to Liz Smith. Many people might think that might have been an end to a career. Tell us what you were doing and how it helped you get where you are today.
Well, I came to this public relations company practically right out of graduate school in journalism, and I looked very polished. And I had a grasp of who was in the know. You know, who was popular at that time. And it was way before the Kardashian sisters, but there were certain people that were on the radar screen. And so I had a client who wanted it to be mentioned in the columns that this one shopped and this one bought this. This is way before we had all these social, you know, blogs.
Right.
And so because I was hip to who was important and who was interesting, they would tell me who was in the store, and then I would call Liz Smith's assistant. Now I'm really going into the archives here of my brain. And her assistant was by the name of St. Clair Pugh, P-U-G-H. And I would call St. Clair Pugh and tell him, by the way, Cheryl Teagues was in the store today, and she bought a humidor for her boyfriend. And then the next day, in Liz Smith's column, it would just say, Cheryl Teagues seen at such and such a store buying a humidor. So I tell that story in the book because people think, you know, a lot of these young people think, you know, I graduated from college, I should, you know, be doing brain surgery. Well, no, you have to start at the bottom, and you have to show full engagement with whatever they ask you to do. And even though I had my master's in journalism, I was quite content to feed gossip columns to St. Clair Pew if it meant that I'd move ahead in the company.
And it certainly paid off for you because you went on to work with some of the best communications companies in America. Booktrip.com described this book as, and the title of the book again is The Essentials of Fabulous, because whatever doesn't work here anymore. Booktrip.com described this book as the quintessential read for anyone looking to step out of the humdrum and into the memories of everyone they meet. The Essentials of Fabulous is a sharp, witty look into the realities of today's social and business worlds. Tell us how you'd describe the book, Ellen.
Well, I considered the book sort of like a primer, sort of like an ABC on how you obtain the word fabulous, because fabulous has no meaning anymore. Fabulous shoes, fabulous new development of houses, fabulous means nothing anymore. When I looked at the material that I had been working on my blog for the executive coaching practice that I have, I noticed that I use the word fabulous probably more than any other word, because I think to make it in this world today, you cannot be ordinary. You really have to stand out. You have to be memorable. You have to have impeccable manners. You have to be warm and gracious. You have to nail all the 10 qualities of what it is to be fabulous. And I kept seeing people sabotage their own career trajectory, or even their social life, because they were missing the boat on certain qualities that may seem very small, but when they start adding up, they leave you with a reputation for not being particularly fabulous. And my goal in my life is that you walk away from any encounter with me feeling charged, feeling like I refilled your gas tank. And that's what fabulous people do. They refill your gas tank so you can go out and do something positive.
I love it. I remember when I was 17 and working with my father, and an elderly lady flicked her scarf around her neck as she was saying goodbye, and she said to me, grabbed my arm, and she said, "Darling, I'd rather people dislike me than forget me." And I have never forgotten. it was a long, long time ago. Tell us, you say that the truth is that fabulous, we're not necessarily born fabulous. We don't have to be born with a silver spoon in our mouth. We don't have to have inheritance behind us. Anybody can be fabulous. It's got nothing to do with your zip code.
I absolutely believe that. I just started with a new dentist, and my dentist had retired, and I'm now introduced to this gentleman. And the minute he walked into the examining room, I just felt this warmth. I felt like I was being enveloped in kind of a fleece blanket. And he examined me, but he also was chatting away, and everything he said was very positive. And then when I walked out to pay, I noticed his diplomas. He had gone to all state universities, so obviously he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth. And I went back to see him, and I said, "You know, I want to tell you something, Dr. Ulster. You're fabulous." He said, what do you mean? "You know what? You did everything on your own. No one handed it to you. You've kept your sensibility. You're warm as toast. Your work looks great. I just think you're fabulous." So and he was, you know, what patient comes back? Usually they come back and go, "I'm not happy with my bill."
Right?
Complaining is seems to be the raison d'être. But how about telling people they're terrific? I did a blog a couple of months ago, "Praise the Lord," LAUD. Praise the people that praise you. Praise people, make them feel good about themselves. You know, it's a process. You don't wake up, you're not in the crib sucking on a pacifier and dreaming about being fabulous. You're dreaming about the bottle coming to you.
Right.
But as you get older, you start looking at people that have a certain panache, a certain style, a certain graciousness. And if you're smart, you take that skill and you make it part of yours.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I want to ask you if we can look at some of those 10 steps that you share in the book to being fabulous, because I think this book is fabulous. We're talking in this segment with Ellen Lubin-Sherman, and her book is called The Essentials of Fabulous. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
Hi, this is Julie Forbes. Join me on Wednesday afternoons from 2 to 3 p.m. for the Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. Listen to discussions on dog-related topics and call in to voice your opinion or ask my opinion about your dog. We will talk about everything from dog behavior to pet food to dog training programs in prisons. The Dog Talk Show, an evolved perspective on life with dogs. I'm your host, Julie Forbes. Tune in Wednesdays from 2 to 3 p.m. on Alternative Talk 1150.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicky St. Clair.
News, traffic, and weather? Now you can get your information fixed weekdays on Alternative Talk 1150 a.m.
And welcome back, our fabulous listeners. We are talking in this segment about being fabulous, the essentials of fabulous, with Ellen Lubin-Sherman. And I wanted to look in this segment, Ellen, at some of the 10 steps. You highlight 10 areas where fabulous people shine. And the first one, you say that for you, the road to fabulous starts at passion for life. And I was telling you during the commercial, I hear this all the time with colleagues, some colleagues that I work with, but it's almost like a fake passion. You're talking about a real passion for life. So share some of that with us, if you would.
Well, I couldn't figure out the order in which they were to go. And so I went to a young man who was the epitome of fabulous, the epitome. And I asked him, what do you think is the hallmark of someone who's fabulous? And he said, they're passionate. I said, okay, that'll be number one. Because the truth is, when you're around people that are passionate, they're passionate about a lot of things, not just about what they do for a living, but they're passionate about silly things too. And passionate people have an energy, a drive inside them that make them appreciate everything. They're just fully engaged. They're on. They're really on. They're in the moment. They're not distracted. They're just wonderful to be around. I call them intoxicating. When I'm around a fabulous person who's passionate, and it can be about anything. It could be about being a fabulous organic farmer, or they can be someone who is leading a heart transplant team. If they're passionate, when they start talking about what they do, I get excited too. I get excited.
Right, right. It's contagious.
It's contagious, and people that are very demoralized and feeling sad about what they're doing, they also are contagious. So it's important to always be looking for options and opportunities if you're not happy. It's very easy to fall into a rut, and fabulous people, the minute they see they're falling into a rut, they go and reach for help because they don't want to stay in that rut for too long.
Yes. You talk in that segment about avoiding pessimism and frenemies. Very important to avoid frenemies, right?
Absolutely. And the second thing I mentioned, of course, is authenticity, which, of course, is so important because of the fact we're, a lot of us are posing as something that we're not. And the reason we're posing is because we don't really love ourselves enough and feel content to just be ourselves. So we pretend we're busy when we're not. We pretend we don't have time when we see someone we know. And we bury our heads in our BlackBerry rather than talk to somebody on the line waiting for a cup of coffee. We do a lot of things that are really not in our best interest. And someone who's authentic, who's real, who's genuine, is the first one to admit they can be an idiot. I mean, I'm always saying, oh, I'm such an idiot, in a sort of a lighthearted way, but it puts people at ease. Because having written this book, they kind of think that, oh, you must be so fabulous. And I'm the first person to say, are you kidding me? I'm in training. I'm in boot camp.
We're all in training.
Exactly. I mean, unless you're just at the top of your game, like Meryl Streep, to me, she's fabulous in so many different ways, the way she's raised her kids, the way she knocks every movie out of the park. But, I mean, those people are just bigger than life. Most of us are just in training. We're just trying to make ourselves really be memorable. Because in today's anemic economy, being memorable, having a great reputation, standing out from the pack, so important.
Mm.
So important.
Absolutely. It is critical. You talk in step three about they have amazing attitude and are known for their amazing attitude. And you talk about brio. Talk about that a little, if you would. I wasn't familiar with that term.
I'm sorry, talk about what?
Brio.
Oh.
Vigor and vivacity.
Oh, okay. You're talking about get it? I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's okay. There's a segment in here where you talk about brio, which is just people who live with vivacity and with vigor and the importance of that.
Oh, brio, yes.
Brio.
I first encountered the word brio when I read a story about the late, the late Sidney Pollack had done a film about the architect Frank Gehry. And he went and interviewed a number of people who had worked with Frank Gehry, whether it was Barry Diller on Frank Gehry's really iconic building on the West Side Highway, or the museum he had done in Spain. And none of them really talked about his work at the top. They all talked about how much fun he was, how much fun he brought to every project, how they laughed and laughed the whole day, even though they were doing the work. He brought this brio, this sense of joy, to every project. And I think Show Me the Brio is a sidebar in the book, but it's really important. A lot of bosses will come in and talk to me, and they go, my staff doesn't have much energy. I said, well, you need to help them. You need to help them show you the brio. And that's the manager job. That's senior level has to exude that brio. And wherever we are, no matter what we're doing, whether we're bringing in our laundry, show me the brio.
Yes.
Show me the energy. Give me something. Give me something so that it's an encounter that I'll go home and remember. The guy who sold me apples in the supermarket, he showed me the brio when the special apples came in the fall. He wasn't making money on those apples, but he had brio. He had energy and he had lust. And I love people that have lust for life.
Yes, yes. And it creates a connection there. Step number eight, you say fabulous people just get it. And that we don't talk enough about the it factor. What is the it factor to you? What does it mean to you?
Well, I really dread talking to someone who completely doesn't know anything that's going on in the culture. I mean, even the Octomom. If you don't know who the Octomom is, you're living in some sort of little cave. People that get it, they just know things. They're curious. They want to be plugged in. They don't want to be expired past their date. You know, people that say to me, you know, in my day, who cares about your day? It's not your day anymore.
Right.
You have to know what's going on today. You have to read the paper or look at a website or listen to the radio or do something so that you know what's going on, that they took over Tripoli, and that they arrested three of Gaddafi's sons. I want to know that you know what's going on in the world, because if you really are living in a cave, I'd really rather look at my BlackBerry and play some crazy bird game. Mm. And I don't think we put enough emphasis into it. People spend a lot of time on their job, and they tell me they're too busy to really be with it and get it. And guess what? It shortchanges them. Because people that get it are much more fun to be with.
I agree. And we talk a lot in the corporate world these days about bandwidth. I just don't have enough bandwidth, meaning I don't have the resources or the time or the energy to get it done. You use bandwidth in a totally different perspective here, really, because you say fabulous people have a huge bandwidth. What do you mean by that? Fabulous people have a huge bandwidth.
Oh, it's so important. The bandwidth is so important. I mean, so many people have such small bandwidths, meaning that they can only talk to people that they know, people that they're familiar with. And the people with the big bandwidth, I'll tell you, one of the people that's known for having a very big bandwidth is Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby will come to a major event, and he'll go into the kitchen and say hello to all the wait staff. He loves to have a big bandwidth. He'll talk to the professor. He'll talk to the CEO. He'll talk to the waiter. He loves meeting people. It energizes him.
Right.
And the people with a big bandwidth also are able to collect information. You know, you don't always get information from the CEO. Sometimes the waiter might. I mean, there was a wonderful Curb Your Enthusiasm last week, where the waiter told Larry David something that was going on at another table. And I had to laugh because the waiter had the big bandwidth. And big bandwidth people are great networkers because they talk to everybody. They don't only talk to people that are up or down. They're all horizontal. Everybody's the same. Everybody offers something that's worth listening to. And I think that that's what makes them really great, you know, conversationalists. They do have a big bandwidth.
Yeah, and, you know, in our next segment, we're going to talk about people who are lonely and how to overcome that a little bit. You talk in here about how to excel at small talk, and having a big bandwidth there certainly helps on that. What would be some other tips that you'd give to people about creating small talk?
Well, I try to call small talk smart talk, because the first thing you have to do is find a way to engage with someone on a kind of like shallow level. For example, if you're wearing a great pair of stockings, I'm going to come over to you and go, I love your stockings. Now we're beginning the relationship. Then we can have you been here before? Have you ever attended one of these events? I'm new here. It's always a good way to like start in a very shy kind of like unassuming way, and then never ask someone what they do for a living. Ask someone what they do for leisure activities. I don't care what you do for a living. That's secondary. I want to know who you are. I want to know what you care about. I want to know what makes you excited about life. And so you have to approach people from a humanistic point of view, not just to see if you're a doctor or a lawyer, but what makes you tick? What makes you excited? What do you groove on? And that way you start the conversation rolling. And I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. My husband and I went out for dinner, and it was one of these restaurants where you sit at a long table. And a young woman had the audacity to ask my husband what he did for a living. I think she was 13. Luckily, it wasn't my child, because had it been my child, that child would have sat in his room for 2 days. For asking that question. That was most inappropriate and completely outrageous. So I never ask people what they do for a living. It means nothing to me. I want to know who you are.
Yeah.
What do you feel about? What do you care about? And let's try to find that nexus, that point that we both agree on, and let the conversation fly from there.
That's great advice. And I think so often when people do ask what you do for a living, they automatically pigeonhole you, whether you fit in that pigeonhole or not.
Absolutely.
One last thing I'd like you to just share very quickly with us, because we are at the almost at the end of our segment, Ellen. You talk about fabulous people have a board, meaning like a board of directors. But tell us how you've used that in your life, if you would.
The board of directors?
Yes.
Oh, I love my board. I have an amazing board. I mean, not my board doesn't even know each other. But when I'm in a spot where I just can't figure my way out of it, when I've like walked myself into a corner, I go to select people and I say, I need your help. You know, building bridges is so important no matter where you are. You have can't bowl alone. I don't enjoy bowling alone. I like to bowl with someone else. So the board of directors is there to support you. And let me tell you what the key issues are. You got to find people that are smart and savvy. They're on it. They're with it. They get it. They're plugged in. They know about Octomom. Number two, they have to care about you to be successful. You don't pick people that are jealous of you, that will give you bad advice, that might second-guess you or look perplexed when you talk about a dream. They have to green-light your dreams. They have to want you to get it maybe even more than you want it yourself. And you have to also keep them in the loop. If you've taken a piece of advice from somebody on your board, you have to tell them right away, that piece of advice you gave me, slam dunk. It worked beautifully. I can't thank you enough. And they'll be ready for you when you need them again. Too many people ask for advice. You don't know if they took it, and you never hear from them again. And it's very, very rude to do that. So you got to nurture your board. You got to marinate your board.
Yeah.
But the board is there for you when you need it. And if you don't make a board, start today. Make a list of five people that you know who are really smart, generous, and really, really connected. And ask them if they'll serve on your board and offer to serve on their board. And open up a conversation about this board of directors, because you can't climb Mount Everest by yourself. Everybody needs someone to carry some of the weight.
Very true, very true. And this really is a fabulous book. I really enjoyed reading it. It's very witty. It's got some great tips in here. You talk a lot about manners and etiquette today, which I think is important because we are losing it. A final quick thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today, Ellen.
Well, thank you. I loved every minute talking to you, and I hope that your readers get to see it and maybe perhaps flex their fabulous.
There we go. And the book, again, is called The Essentials of Fabulous, because whatever doesn't work here anymore. My guest, Ellen Lubin Sherman. You can find out much more about Ellen at essentialsoffabulous.com, essentialsoffabulous.com. And we're going to go to break, but we're going to lead you into break with, I was trying to think, because we're celebrating our fourth anniversary throughout the month of August, so I was trying to think of a clip that might work here to play us into break. And I remember a conversation I had with Barbara Winters, who was the creator of Joyfully Jobless, BarbaraWinter.com. And she was talking about people who'd given up the mundane jobs in their life that they didn't like, either because of layoffs or they just decided they'd had enough or they wanted a change. And they decided to do something entirely different, which in my book makes them fabulous. So we're going to hear that right now. Let's look at some ideas that you shared. Some of these I found on your website, some were in the book. Because, as you said, we're not looking at traditional businesses here. We don't have to look at traditional businesses here. Ways that people have started successful businesses, there were people who were turning blocks of ice into temporary works of art. You talked about somebody who rents out, this made me laugh, 150 mud turtles for the local turtle race in Minnesota.
That's one of my favorites.
And she took the business over from a local minister who sent his kids to college on the money he made renting out mud turtles.
I know. Don't you love it? I've been trying to get a mud turtle thing going in the country, but I have failed miserably.
Yeah.
But I love that idea. It's hilarious.
There's a guy building tree houses. They've become very popular in Seattle. I was watching something on the TV last week about a hotel that has treehouse cabins. This one I like too. There was one fellow who liked swords. He began making swords when he was 9 years old. And today he and his wife, I assume, own a company that makes historically accurate ancient armor and sell about 160 pieces every month to collectors around the world.
I know. You must have checked the article on my website called You Could Never Make a Living Doing That. And that's one of my favorite things, is to kind of collect these really wacky, one-of-a-kind ideas that are succeeding. And I always try to imagine the kind of resistance they must have gotten from their family and friends when they said, you know, I think we're going to start making authentic replica swords. I think people really go for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I like. There was also a former corporate HR manager, because, of course, many people are being laid off, losing their jobs. But a former corporate HR manager who didn't necessarily want to go back into working for a company. So he now consults one day a week with five different clients.
I know. Isn't that great?
Yeah. This one I loved. I mean, who... Who would have thought of this? Starting a cow sitting service. Tell us about that.
Well, I heard this young couple talking about this, and it was a young couple. They'd just been married a short time, both grew up on dairy farms in Minnesota, and that was their dream, was to own their own dairy farm. And they weren't at the point where they could afford to set themselves up in business, and they realized that dairy farmers never get to go on vacation. And so they started a cow sitting service, and their first year in business, they had like one or two weeks that weren't booked. They were that bad. They were
amazing.
The ones who weren't getting a vacation.
And thought it fake it, the deviously dangerous, ridiculously cool, let's make it fabulous. Fabulous.
Looking for unconditional love? An exercise buddy or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967, because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Catch a wave and you're sitting on top of the world.
If you're still waiting to catch the perfect wave, land the perfect job, hook the perfect partner, join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Kristen Moeller will share the tools and resources you need to stop waiting and start living. Vicki will also talk with New York Times bestselling author Andrew Gross about his new suspense thriller, Eyes Wide Open. See more at conversationslive.net and join Vicki on Facebook for new podcast links and news updates.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Like what you hear? Be sure and support the sponsors who support your favorite programs on Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, in this segment, we are talking with Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, MD. He's the best-selling co-author of Calming Your Anxious Mind and the 5 Good Minute series. He's a consulting associate in the Duke Department of Psychiatry and the founder and director of the Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction Program at Duke University's Center for Integrative Medicine. His co-author on this book, a couple of his books, is Wendy Milston, NC. In addition to being a freelance writer, Wendy is a certified holistic nutrition consultant specializing in diet and stress reduction. And their new book is called True Belonging, Mindful Practices to Help You Overcome Loneliness, Connect with Others, and Cultivate Happiness. Dr. Jeffrey Brantley, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Vicki. It's great to be with you.
I'm very pleased to have you here because I said at the top of the hour, I Googled, oh dear, this was shocking. I Googled Lonely People 2011 and got 38 million hits. And then I Googled songs about being lonely and got 58 million plus hits. So what was it that interested you in this topic to begin with?
Well, you know, gosh, those are frightening numbers, aren't they?
Scary.
You know, part of what happened was, you know, I've been working in mindfulness for many years, working in psychiatry for many years, and Wendy and I had been doing our 5 Good Minutes books and gotten a lot of positive feedback about short mindfulness practices, and we were asked if we might consider writing a small book about mindful practices to help with loneliness. Because you know, we sort of knew, but then when the publishers approached us, they pointed out some similar kind of really amazing numbers about what a, I don't know, epidemic's probably not the right word, but what an enormous burden it is for people to feel lonely, and so we were happy to try and offer something that hopefully will be helpful.
Yeah, and I read and I substantiated this with other research that the numbers of people who say there's no one with whom they discuss important matters has nearly tripled between 85 and 2004, and I really couldn't find anything very current on that. But just that number itself is really staggering, and I'm guessing with social media and the fact that people can lock themselves away in a room and, you know, play on Facebook all day, I'm guessing maybe that's increased.
Well, it might have, you know, and it's a kind of a paradox. So some of the science that we looked at, you know, indicates that the experience of loneliness is really very subjective. In other words, what people tell themselves about their relationships and their situation has a lot to do with how they describe themselves as being lonely. So, and yet there's those realities that you touched on, you know, that maybe there's no one in a person's life that the person feels safe enough to talk about deeply held matters, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a very complicated situation.
Yeah, definitely. And, of course, I think most of us are familiar with the correlating health issues that have been associated with isolation in particular. You know, I've read studies many times that cultures that tend to stay together in family units, you know, in extended family units, tend to be healthier than us Westerners who might live thousands and thousands of miles away from family and really close friends.
Yes, well, there's all of that. So it's certainly that part's undeniable. And then there's this whole other sort of dimension about how much does one actually feel connected to the world around them, to themselves, as well as to dear ones, you know, to loved ones. I'm reminded of a study that came out some years ago now. Ellen Langer did this study, or she wrote about it in her book Mindfulness, and she talked about people in nursing homes where they, as I remember it, they gave some of the people like a plant to take care of, mm-hmm. and other people didn't. You know, they just said, well, the staff will take care of everything in your room, and they left it at that. And the people who wound up with a plant to take care of actually did better by the different measures they used than the people who didn't have anything to take care of, you know? So
yeah.
That opens up another dimension to this sense of feeling connected, feeling belonging, and how do we talk to ourselves about that?
Yeah, and you talk in the beginning of the book about, you know, how we internalize all of that. And I can see that as being paramount in whether we define ourselves as being lonely or not. You talk also about painful memories. How can old painful memories keep us stuck and lonely?
Well, you know, that's a very excellent question. The one example that comes to my mind about that comes from the work of the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression, John Teasdale and Mark Williams and Zendel Siegel and their colleagues, and they found that if people had a history of depression and a tendency to be very self-critical about themselves, that in a situation where if they waved at someone and that someone did not wave back, a person with that sort of history of the depression and the narratives that go with it and whatever the causes were in their early relationships, their trauma or whatever it might be. But if they had that history of the depression, if the person doesn't wave back, the tendency is to launch into or fall into a series of negative inner dialogues and self-critical commentary, which could actually lead to more risk for depression. In contrast, a person without that history of kind of trauma or depression and the internalization, the memory of it, if the person doesn't wave back, that person without that history tend to just shrug it off and move on.
Right. Now, I have to be honest, when I first saw heard about the book, I thought you were going to give us tips for getting out there and socializing and holding conversations and meeting new people. And I was kind of surprised when I saw the book was mostly, well, it's all about being mindful, about mindfulness. But having read it now, I can understand why you start with us, with ourselves.
Yes, yes. Well, thank you. I'm glad it came through clearly to you. I worried about that, actually.
Yes, no, definitely. Tell us how, for those who haven't read the book, how does mindfulness help us nurture connections and relationships? And why is that where we need to start?
Yes. Well, mindfulness is a very popular word these days, mm-hmm. actually, and it refers to a core or essential human quality. Some people have called it the quality of mind that notices what is present without judgment and without interference. And in other words, we all have this, you know. People have noticed maybe that they step outside and the air is warm on their face, or in Seattle you might feel the moisture of the raindrops. I don't know. And there's a moment of just noticing that sensation. Many people, probably all of us, have had the experience of noticing our inner thoughts. You know, we're worried about something, we wake in the night and our mind is rattling on about something or another. And there's a moment or two before we get swept into the story where we actually just notice, oh, my mind is really, you know, talking again, or it's really sad or worried again. And then we get usually caught up in the story.
Right.
So the mindfulness, that's natural mindfulness. We've all got it in varying degrees. And what we point to in the book is that, like a talent or a strength that we have, mindfulness can be cultivated. And when we cultivate this knowing, this non-judging, non-interfering awareness in the different moments of our life and the situations, we could actually begin to gain self-awareness. And that self-awareness can open up new choices for us and help us step out of old kind of views and perspectives that might be interfering. So to back up, you know, you mentioned about tips for socializing. Well, if a person really can cultivate mindfulness and look deeply inward and see that maybe they are their own worst enemy that way, they tell themselves, nobody would like me, or I don't know what to say, then that is holding them back from any kind of a tip. But if they can recognize they just have that kind of not true self-view going on from whatever reason, and say, well, you know, what if I just didn't believe it so much and tried a new tip, and the tip says whatever it says, then the tip they try will actually have more power and could help them more.
Right. One of the things you say is that when we're lonely, when people are feeling lonely, they often are using the word I all the time. And you say, if only we could shift that around to we and start thinking more outside of ourselves, we might see a difference there. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit more about that.
Yes. You know, the one way I put that is that my ego is not as important as it thinks it is. You know, but we all have these egos, and some of us, those egos are more important than they think they are,
right.
Not as important as they think. And so the I, me, mine perspective arises quickly. In the book, we give an example, and it's not a bad thing. It's not a sin or a defect. It's important to have a good ego strength, good self-esteem. But when that view starts kind of crystallizing so that the whole world is viewed, you know, through what can it do for me or what is it doing to me, then it can be quite a problem, really. And an easy way to kind of step out of that, or and not always easy, but a simple way, is to begin to practice gratitude for the things we have, to see how we depend on others for the things in our life, the good fortune we have. and to begin to think more compassionately about others. And what can happen from that is that that hardening around the I, me, mine story can soften and become a much more open into a sense of connectedness.
Mm. And then that kind of leads into oftentimes we put up, I know I've done this myself when I don't want to talk, if I'm like on the beach and I just need an hour of solitude. You know, you can put up walls that say, don't come talk to me.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes that can be a habit for people. And, you know, and that's, then they end up finding themselves lonely. How do they start to dissolve those boundaries that we sometimes put up?
Well, you know, again, I think in a way is recognizing, trusting ourselves, oneself to be aware, just to notice that, you know, like in your example on the beach. Well, what you noticed is that you needed some solitude.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't loneliness. You actually needed some solitude, which is something most of us need here and there, or a lot even. And so you had a good constructive way of creating that for yourself. It's good self-care. But what can happen is that the mind can keep that method of solitude. It could become a kind of a habit. So the awareness, you know, like, why am I putting up this barrier? And if it's about sort of fear or something else, maybe to practice self-compassion and see if it might not. There are a number of ways one can lower those barriers and tricks, you know, for reaching out, as you say.
Right.
And, but I think, again, it starts with what's the source of that energy of the barrier. Is it a healthy desire for solitude, or is it coming out of some lower self-esteem or anger or some other place that needs some self-compassion?
Mm. And I should say, you know, in each of these, there are many topics in the book, many mindful practices. You do give reflective practices after each topic that you talk about. And in dissolving the boundary, one of the things you talk about is, you know, once you've dissolved the barriers, you offer a new message in their place, such as, I'm open-hearted, I'm open to giving and receiving, I am connected to others, which I think would instantly put you in a place of peace and openness.
Yes, and this is, in some, like the 12-step tradition, this would be similar to the affirmations that we use. And in the world of positive psychology, the work of Barbara Fredrickson and her colleagues, Barbara talks a lot about cultivating the palette of positivity, of positive emotions, which would include things like the gratitude or the positivity or the confidence building, and that we actually need to practice and cultivate those qualities in our life, because the tendency is when negative things happen, they hit us harder. That's sort of the way we're wired as human beings.
Yeah. I have to say, I often, when I'm walking my dog early in the morning, will take 5 minutes to just do my little gratitude ritual in my head, or even sometimes say it out loud. And it makes a tremendous difference to my day, especially if I'm under a lot of pressure and a lot of stress. It kind of just puts me in a whole different spot mentally. It's very powerful.
Yes, and, you know, it is powerful, and it points to the fact that we are constantly changing as human beings. And so if we can kind of reprogram our nervous system in a way, our brains and hearts, with that kind of practice, then it makes us receptive to our day in a way that we might not have been.
Mm. I love this one, and it reminds me of one of my favorite films, Shirley Valentine, where this housewife is totally ignored and abused, if you like, by her family. They just take her totally for granted, and she decides, you know what, I've had enough, I'm going to Greece. And while she's on holiday in Greece, she has this epiphany and she finds herself again. She finds Shirley Valentine, the girl she used to be. And the phrase she comes out with, I'm in love with life. And you say fall in love with life. So tell us how we fall in love with life.
Well, you know, it might be easier than you think, and you might not have to go to Greece. Although that probably would
help. It'd be a nice trip.
It could be a nice trip, that's right. Well, you know, again, it comes back to recognizing, we talk a lot about the view that our little personality takes on, and as one cultivates awareness and cultivates practices like generosity and gratitude and to break out, to flex that view is the way we put it, not to be so locked in a rigid view, then, you know, the mystery of this life can reveal itself. You know, the beauty of a sunrise, or you see the dew on a leaf, or you hear the sound of a child's laughter, that by being present in this moment, we connect with that, and it connects with us. And there's the beauty of life right there.
Yeah, yeah. And I love this quote in the book, Judy Garland. My mother grew up with Judy Garland and was a huge Judy Garland fan. And Judy Garland said, "If I'm such a legend, then why am I so lonely?" And she says, "Let me tell you, legends are all very well if you've got somebody around who loves you."
Yeah.
And you say in the book, it's not the number of people we surround ourselves with. It's the quality of the connection of the relationships. It's the satisfaction you get from them. Talk a little about that, if you would, please.
Well, I was talking with someone earlier, and they were pointing out in social media now, people have hundreds of friends, you know, on their social media site. But the sense of connection might be very limited.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, our conversation unfolded about, you know, the deep sense of connection often is a shared history with someone and a sense of safety in their presence and, the history of kind of sharing your feelings and your thoughts and your dreams and hopes and your pains. And that is something that really gets into that realm when we talk about love, I think. You know, you have love for another, you're there for them, they have love for you, and they're there for you like that.
Right, right. So what would you like to leave our listeners with today on this thought? That I read here that the goal of this book is to offer comfort and inspiration. More importantly, its goal is to become a resource for liberation and the discovery of new possibilities and joy for anyone trapped in the perception that they are somehow absolutely alone, isolated, or excluded. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Jeff?
Well, that notion in the shorthand form is really, we just hope that people will remember the mystery and the beauty of being human, and that we are all deeply interconnected. And if people can remember that and trust themselves somehow and find ways to flex their perspectives if they're otherwise, then, that would be the good thing. The people could actually, they're going to remember what they've already got, you know, and bring attention to what's already possible in their life.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Now, do you have a website, Dr. Brantley?
We don't have a website for this book. We have a website for the other series, the 5 Good Minutes series. It's 5goodminutes.com. But no, we don't at this point. We haven't set one up for True Belonging.
Okay. So, but they can find a little bit more about you at 5 Minutes.
They can, 5goodminutes.com.
5goodminutes.com. Well, I want to thank you for being with us today. This book, True Belonging, has over 30 reflective practices to help you explore your interdependence with all living things. It's a very good book. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Vicki, and thanks for all your good work, and congratulations on that 4th anniversary.
Well, thank you, and we're going to play everyone out today with a clip, another clip from Barbara Winter, and she moved to a new town, knew nobody, and this is how she made friends when she moved to that new town, and she made a little bit of money. I just want to tell you before we go, you can find out more about upcoming shows at conversationslive.net, and you can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also find me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair, and again on Facebook at Vicki St. Clair. So hop on board if you want to follow us on social media and join us. And True Belonging is Dr. Jeffrey Brantley's book, and we're going to play a clip now from BarbaraWinter.com. We ready, Eric? Moved to Boulder, Colorado yourself. You were, in your own words, in the depths of despair around the holiday season. You hardly knew a soul. You were depressed because you thought, I'm never going to get invited to any parties. And then you had this brilliant idea about how to get to lots of parties, meet new people, and make money.
Yes. And that was so much fun. That was an incredibly fun thing. I just put a little ad in the paper offering to help at parties. And so you could, I think the tagline was like, be a guest at your own party. And so I got to go to all these Christmas parties and get paid to go there.
I have no sound. And that, again, was a clip from Barbara Winter. You can find out more about her, barbarawinters.com, barbarawinters.com. And please join us next week. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us today.
If you're still waiting to catch the perfect wave, land the perfect job, hook the perfect partner, join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Kristen Muller will share the tools and resources you need to stop waiting and start living. Vicki will also talk with New York Times bestselling author Andrew Gross about his new suspense thriller, Eyes Wide Open. See more at conversationslive.net and join Vicki on Facebook for new podcast links and news updates.